Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. As Americans prepare to celebrate Thanksgiving, coronavirus cases in the United States are out of control as death rates are surging, breaking 2,000 a day, a rate not seen since earlier this year. Fatalities are expected to continue into next year, especially if Americans continue to travel in record numbers as they did this weekend, despite dire warnings from the Centers for Disease Control urging Americans to stay put and making the case that relatives infected over Thanksgiving may not live to see Christmas. In Congress, stimulus efforts are stalled as lawmakers now fear the National Defense Authorization Act for the year will also prove elusive. The Federal Aviation Administration has cleared Boeing 737 MAX to return to flight as airlines prepare to put the jetliner back in operational service and air carriers like Delta consider buying the jet. Opposition to arms sales to the United Arab Emirates continue as French President Emmanuel Macron's statements in the wake of the beheading of the teacher Samuel Paty are fueling ire in the Muslim world. And meanwhile, the Joint Strike Fighter may be landing its latest order, and the Eurofighter is on a strong run. Joining us to discuss the week on world markets, as they do every Sunday, are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us.
Vago, always a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having us, Vago.
Always great to be on, Vago. Thanks.
Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage. Overall, Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Ron, walk us through the week. Obviously, the street was dominated with news of more positive vaccine, that the new vaccines are coming out, efficacy rates of 95 or more than 90%. That said, we should point out that these vaccines aren't going to get into popular service, certainly until probably not until next year, when it really starts affecting things. And most people think that 21 is still going to be tough. IATA, the chief of IATA, Alex de Juniac, the talented former Thales executive who then was chief executive of Air France before taking the International Air Transport Association job, is making still dire predictions for airlines. Give us a sense on where we are and where we're going.
Yeah, so on the week, when you look at the broad indices, the Dow on the week was down just almost a percent, just under a percent. Same thing with the S&P. If you look at some of the big bellwether stocks in the U.S., Boeing was up about 6.5%. Raytheon Technologies was up about 5.5%. In Europe, Airbus was up about 3.5% on the week. Lockheed was down on the week. We saw a lot of volatility in the week around the announcements, expectations, what this all means. There's a couple things going on. So during the week, as you mentioned, IATA, Alexander was at a conference, and he mentioned that IATA is now expecting the global airline industry to lose $100 billion this year. That's up from their previous forecast of about $85 billion. And that most likely implies in 2021 that it gets worse than where they were before. And in 2021, IATA is or was expecting the industry to lose on the order of, call it $22, $23 billion. So that number probably gets a little bit worse. And it seems like that the street's getting used to this and starting to digest that that's kind of always darkest before dawn. And that really seems to be the case with the virus, right? I mean, we've got a light at the end of the tunnel, presumably, with these vaccines, with the very high level efficacy rates. And it does seem like they're going to be, worked into the system, but that's going to take some time. And between now and then, it seems like things are going to get pretty bad. Most of the U.S. airlines were taking down their forward bookings expectations because of the travel situation around COVID. No big surprise, right? Thanksgiving in the U.S. is the biggest travel holiday in the U.S. typically. And this year, it's going to be a weird Thanksgiving from a travel perspective. Even the AAA, the Automobile Association, is expecting numbers down year on year for even folks driving around traveling. So we're going through this period now, and I would expect to continue to see volatility in the market As we go through the next several weeks into the end of the year, one of the big thing on investors' minds is, well, what's the next catalyst, right? We know the vaccines are here, are coming, are almost here. What's next? You know what I mean? And I think it's a similar, you know, psychology around Boeing. The 73, you got its thumbs up from the FAA. Now what? Right. Now actually you got to start delivering numbers and planes and cash flow and earning. I mean, you kind of back to the reality of, running a company and delivering numbers.
Sash, what's your sense on where we are on air travel? I mean, obviously there was a spike before this vacation, which does have folks terrified, given that in the United States, I mean, the virus is completely out of control. There is no lockdown, I think. President Trump hasn't even conceded the election, and the administration is withholding information from the incoming administration that wants to figure out some way to tackle it. But if you can just imagine, there's nothing that's likely to happen from a federal standpoint in terms of overseeing or managing this crisis. It's being left to governors and to municipal leaders. From your standpoint, Europe is getting in the thick of it, but it's been locked down now for 10 or 12 or more days, almost 2 weeks now. Where are we in terms of these air travel statistics as you see them? And how do you interpret this vaccine news? And Richard, want to get your sense on this as well. Go ahead.
Look, the air travel numbers are... there's a lot of noise, but they're essentially bouncing around the bottom. So, if you look at last week, if you look at sort of global commercial aircraft movements year on year from Flightradar24, they were actually up a little bit, but only a tiny bit. But Europe is definitely deteriorating, and that's the effect of continuous lockdowns occurring, and it's just squeezing the life out of what little air traffic there is at the moment. It's just very interesting. I mean, living in London, you don't see aircraft in the air at the moment. Normally we get aircraft somewhere in the pattern for Heathrow, every couple of minutes or so. And if you look at, China is clearly up at the moment. But I think one of the interesting things about China is that the individual Chinese airlines show that their load factors, their seat factors are absolutely dreadful. So they basically put too much capacity back on. They can't fill those seats. So our feeling is that as we go into the winter season, and, particularly once the Thanksgiving effect ends, airlines are going to have to consider very clearly what the starting, the datum is for 2021, the starting point. How much capacity do they really need, and how much do they dare put on for the summer? And, given where we are now, the odds are that they are going to cut their capacity for the summer, when they make their big decisions in, let's say, January, relative to where we are now, because the numbers are net deteriorating a bit.
And let me just ask a stimulus question as part of this as well, right? I mean, Poland and Hungary's objection sort of put the whole European package in jeopardy. I know, what's the airline bailout, stimulus, supplemental funding, whatever you want to call it, situation look like in Europe? And Richard, want to get your sense as well in the United States, because our stimulus deal is still stalled over the exact same factors it's been stalled over since April, pretty much.
There isn't an airline stimulus deal in Europe, period. There are national stimulus deals or national deals that will benefit airlines, but there is no European deal at all. And there won't be, because airlines and air travel are still done on a European basis. So, if Germany wants to help Lufthansa, there's a surprise, then they will do. If Air France wants to help Air France, then they will do. But there's no stimulus package coming out of the EU that will help, although clearly the European Central Bank having interest rates that you need a microscope to find is pretty favourable, because it means they can find debt funding. But I don't think we should be looking at a stimulus deal to help airlines. Ultimately, there's got to be an economic recovery. And economic recoveries in Europe come fairly slowly.
And do you think it's a big problem what we're seeing from Poland and Hungary holding up the broader coronavirus European package?
Yes, it is. But I think it shows the problems that the European Union has got that, I mean, arguably the problem with the European Union is that it is based too far west in Europe. It has a Western Europe mindset. And it should be no surprise that it's Eastern European countries that are saying, we're not getting enough out of this.
Right. Richard, your sense on where we are, where we're going, and at what point U.S. air carriers are going to need that next stimulus injection?
Yeah, I mean, I think now would be good, but you still have this scorched earth thing going on. And it's bizarre. Obviously, a week ago, Steven Mnuchin looked like he would get out of the Trump administration with a pretty darn good reputation. But ending the emergency landing program seems like a pretty good way to remove that possibility. I mean, everything is just being dismantled, and I don't know what the shadow government can do to keep things from getting worse before January 20th. And even then, it might be a bit of a hard time. On the positive side, I tend to echo Ron's thoughts that this is really a darkest before the dawn moment, not just in terms of governance and government support, but also in terms of traffic and everything. I mean, as Ron pointed out, Boeing was up. Well, so were movie theater stocks. I think everybody is sort of saying.
Yeah, and cruise companies saw a jump, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think everyone is saying what I personally believe, which is that there's nothing to see here, folks. If you could just blot out the 15 months of this this atrocity, we'll be back to where we were probably fast. I mean, I fully respect IATA's views, but I don't even think it takes us to early 2024. I think sometime in 2023, if the virus gets under control in mid-2021, which is looking like it might just be from what the vaccine people tell us. And at that point, I think you've got the, up until between then and 2023 and 2024, you've got the magic of moving at a very fast upward angle. Yes, it's psychological because we're way below where we would have been. We're way below peak. But when you're growing, by double-digit rates on a monthly basis, it's just a completely different mindset, a totally different psychology. And it certainly matters when you're making decisions about investing in jets, machine tools, or hiring people. So I'm kind of looking forward to that moment. Again, darkest before the dawn, but given that absence of any form of government even pretending to care over here about what's going on with the economy, it's going to be an unusually dark, dark before the dawn.
Ron, by the way, Sash, absolutely love the grandfather clock. It's been a while since we've heard that on the program. So that was very, 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 very reassuring.
Yeah, but you just got the scheduling absolutely right this evening.
Isn't this the part where we could have him identified as a murder suspect on the basis of that being in the background because of something, Agatha Christie?
That's right. No, but why would it? Or it's because we have the turkey gun about ready to fire. We'll get Ron talking about that toward the end of the program for our holiday treat. Richard, you're still talking about something that is still very, very many months away, right? I mean, this is the thing that I find fascinating about markets is, I mean, that's still a June 21 evolution. Ron, let me just bring you in really quickly on this in terms of, when another stimulus package has to happen. And is there concern on the street that there might not be an NDAA at the end of the day? Because that too looks like it's kind of stalled. And, that's something that's seen as a very, very foundational document for us.
Yeah, I mean, on the NDAA, how can I say this? I mean, the street generally likes the government when you don't have agreement. Kind of broadly speaking, it's not as disruptive to the market as you might think. If you go back in recent history and you look at periods where this happened, generally the defense stocks did okay. If we can get that, that's great. But I don't have investors clamoring over, when's it going to happen? What's going to happen? And to some extent, I do think for stimulus, there is some sort of broad expectation that we will get something here at some point. It may not be until we have a new administration. I think the market's been contemplating that as well. But that's kind of why I think we're in a period where you're going to see volatility. right? I mean, there's going to be, you know, really good days and probably some, you know, not so great days around all this. I don't want to call it noise, but around all these events and headlines that are really, really hard to forecast.
Let me get you, Ron, to start us off on the 737. Max is going to be going back into service, obviously grounded since March 2019 after two crashes that killed 349 folks. European regulators are expected to follow the FAA in January. No word yet from the Chinese. As we said, Ed Bastian from CEO of Delta is talking about buying Maxes, which obviously is good news for Boeing, maybe not as good news for Airbus. The Southwest CEO is saying he's going to keep calling it the 737 Max to a question that we had discussed some time ago about whether or not airlines have to call it differently. First, start us off, how much work does Boeing have to do to get these airplanes to the, you know, into customer hands? And does this materially change the outlook for the airplane at the end of the day, or how materially does it change the outlook?
Yeah. So on the first question, my understanding is, and this is just from talking from some industry participants, for the aircraft that were delivered that are currently parked at airlines, right? So to differentiate those from the ones that are sitting in inventory at Boeing, for an airline to get the aircraft, you know, kind of out of storage, ready to go, everything up and running, all the, you know, I think there's five or six different things that the airworthiness directive, you know, stated that they have to go through, including the pilot training. That, you know, on a per aircraft basis, it's about 1,000 man hours per airplane. So that's going to just take some time to do. Presumably, the aircraft at Boeing might take a little bit less because they're less fixed in nature, if that makes sense. I think the second point to make is that our understanding is they do have a number of whitetails, if you will, aircraft that were supposed to get delivered to various airlines that didn't or won't. This week, Norwegian Air Shuttle, right? Those guys went bankrupt, right? So that put a dent in their deliveries, right? So it as just a case in point. So there's some aircraft that don't have owners that, you know, Boeing's going to want to put in place. And an airline like Delta is a really savvy airplane buyer. So generally speaking, if you're selling a bunch of airplanes to Delta, that's probably not good news to the OEM because they're a very, very, very shrewd aircraft buyer. But be that as it may, it's, you know, if they can, you know, move some of those aircraft there, that's good. To the second question, you know, is it really, you know, where do we see the program, you know, is the program somehow impaired? Probably not, ultimately, right? I mean, you know, the 8 Max in particular is a, you know, a fine airplane for its size. You know, it's got a less wide, a more narrow fuselage than its competing airplane, the A320. It's lighter, presumably on a seat basis. It's less expensive to operate. So it will do fine. But the problem is, and we've talked about this before, and, you know, I'm certain, you know, Richard and Sash have thoughts on this, that, you know, Boeing doesn't have as strong an offering in the bigger sister aircraft, you know, namely where the A321LR and XLR sit. That, you know, the 737 MAX 9 and 10 just don't have the same mission profile. And then when you go to a smaller variant of the airplane, the 737 MAX 7, there's really just Southwest, I think, has those. And then that's it. And so when you go down in the product range at Airbus, you know, the A318 and A319 were really no sales champions, but now they have the 220, and the 220 is a fine airplane, right? And so at the low end of the market, they've got the 220. At the high end of the market, they got the A321. And that's probably a bigger pickle, if you will, for Boeing than the MAX 8.
Sash and Richard?
I think Ron highlighted the MAX is very, very difficult positioning. You know, if you have only one model of your four, which is actually competitive, and the other three are not, you've got a problem. In this industry. This industry works on the basis that you can flex your deliveries by different models, you know, with 6 months' notice, sometimes even less than that, and that you get the scale economies of building a lot of different fuselage variants, but most of the components and subsystems and subassemblies of which are completely common. And Airbus does that incredibly well with the A320 family. And Airbus doesn't terribly care, except that they make more money on the big aircraft, the A321s, but they don't terribly care whether the customer buys 19s, 20s, or 21s, because they all come out of the same assembly lines. And they will happily sell you a 319 and then trade up to a 320 or a 321 later on in the process. And Boeing doesn't have that flexibility at all. One of the metrics that we look at, and it's the one that I think should really concern Boeing, is unbuilt backlog. It's the backlog less the aircraft that you have already built but have not yet delivered in the case of Boeing, which is about, you know, 400, 500, 737 MAXs. And since this crisis started, the Airbus unbuilt backlog has gone up a little bit from about 5,700 to just under 6,000 aircraft. The 737 MAX backlog has gone down from 4,200 to under 3,000. Remember, they've already built some of the MAXs. They just haven't delivered them yet. But once your backlog is half that of your competitor, your production rate is either going to be half that of your competitor, or you're going to run out of aircraft sooner, and you're going to have to discount the hell out of them to sell new ones. And this is the wrong market environment to be selling new MAXs at any price. This is a horrible position for Boeing to be in.
Richard?
Yeah, I think we're all crowing horse saying pretty much the same thing. Matter of fact, I think if you hit Control F1 on my computer, it spits out, Boeing very badly needs a new large single aisle. Otherwise, it will lose 10 points in market share. That is glaringly obvious. You know, I mean,
you're such a DOS guy. You're just such a DOS guy.
I like the open architecture sort of approach. I don't like that mystery thing inside, like with Mac. I mean, you just used to have this bell curve, you know, between the 320 class planes or 737 MAX 8 planes. That was the giant middle hump. And then the others were kind of marginal. But 321 Neo, boy, you know, 3,500 plus orders. And Boeing really not anywhere on that chart, and Boeing still in denial. So people ask me about the MAX 8 and ask you about the MAX 8. We all think the MAX 8's a really good plane, but it completely sidesteps right. the issue of competitiveness across the product line.
And right, Ron, correct me if I'm wrong, still no news from Boeing management about what that new midsize airplane is going to be, right?
Nope. Yeah, nothing there. Okay. And to be frank, I'm not expecting anything anytime soon.
Yeah, that's very reassuring for everybody. Richard, let me have you start off on the combat aviation side of things. Is this now, Sash, where you want to take 30 seconds and tell us about MTU's webinar?
That's great. I mean, just to say that I think what was very interesting about MTU, and remember, I mean, MTU is now, particularly in market capitalization terms, I mean, it's bigger than Rolls-Royce at the moment. It's a highly regarded, very, very competent management. It is the big partner to Pratt & Whitney on the geared turbofan, and it's a big partner to General Electric on the wide-bodied engines. So it's there with everybody. And they've just you know, they were really interesting in their capital markets event last week, I think for two reasons. One was that they are starting to look at M&A, and that is astonishing. But they can clearly see non-core businesses being thrown out by other companies, aero engine manufacturing or aero engine subsystem manufacturing businesses. And it seems to me they're prepared to pay, you know, well north of €1 billion for these. So ITP, the Spanish aero engine business, currently for sale from Rolls-Royce, that's one. GKN Aerospace, the Volvo business owned by Melrose, that's another. It's just very, very interesting to see well-capitalized, well-run companies that are prepared to take very big bets at the trough of the cycle on, you know, doubling up in civil aero. And, you know, MTU's management has got at least as good a chance of making this work as anybody. I think it's probably the single most important thing. But I think the other thing is just the degree to which they have pulled this enormous rabbit out of the hat for 2021 by bringing forward a big performance upgrade on the Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan. And I guess that Raytheon Technologies, you know, has started this as well. And this will benefit other members of the Pratt & Whitney partnership. But so they're going to be upgrading almost the entire fleet of geared turbofans at their discretion so that they can reduce their flight hour agreement costs going forward. And that sort of stabilizes 2021, when otherwise I think they would have had a big revenue fall. It's a really interesting way of managing things. We've got to see, you know, whether they can do this profitably or not.
Anybody want to chime in on that before we move to what has been a very, very robust news week on the combat aviation front? Ron or Richard, do you have anything you want to close out on the MTU engines discussion?
Sure. I'll just quickly add that it is important because, you know, when you look at the weakness in two of the three engine primes, GE and Rolls-Royce, and of course, you know, Pratt is part of Raytheon, that makes them somewhat stronger, but, you know, any new product, of course, depends upon getting engines, and two of them are simply not in a position to invest heavily unless the RSP guys are involved, you know, the risk-sharing partners. Right. And MTU is certainly the best, most important. So I think if there's going to be an engine developed for a new jet of any sort in the late 2020s, it's going to be with the full participation and perhaps more than the usual participation of an RSP like MTU.
Let's go. Ron, did you have anything?
Yeah, just one quick little.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think MTU also mentioned that they are going to see some growth in their aftermarket year over year. And one of the drivers of that is actually going to be Pratt & Whitney GTFs coming in for service.
Right.
Right. So the interesting point there is, you know, we're going to start to see the impact of the GTF aftermarket on Raytheon Technologies. Investors have been waiting for that. Finally, seems like it's coming. It got slowed down a little bit because of everything going on, but MTU did say they're going to see that next year.
Let's go to the combat aviation front. Let's start with you, Richard. Greece wants an emergency delivery of F-35s. Obviously, tensions continuing with Turkey over Turkish exploration vessels in what Greece sees as its waters. Arms sales to the Gulf are going to change in a Biden administration. There's already congressional pressure on the F-35 deal, as well as Predator exports. I should note, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems is the maker of the Predator and the Reaper, and is one of sponsors our coverage of strategy. France has some of its own challenges because some of the leaders in the Arab world are upset at the statements the French president has made from his standpoint supporting French values at the end of the day, although some have perceived that to be negative comments about Islam. At the end of the day, and oh, by the way, in the midst of all this, Eurofighter has actually been nailing down a couple of sales, which puts it in kind of contention to keep striking deals, right? So just let's start eating this elephant, and I want to get everybody's sort of sense on what you guys think is important and what the key takeaways are from this sort of slab of combat aviation related news.
Yeah, exciting times. You don't often see the real-time interplay between geopolitics and the fighter market, but we're certainly seeing it here. You know, this confrontation between Erdogan and everybody in the Eastern Mediterranean is sort of taking place in a backdrop of course, heavy weapons spending, understandably. And what's fascinating is that Erdogan and Turkey really are, you know, doing their best to assert themselves, whether it's in Libya or to the east in Armenia, Nagorno-Karabakh, and of course, you know, in the Eastern Med itself. And everybody else is, of course, bulking up on new generation fighters. Turkey hasn't taken a new fighter jet in a couple decades. All they've got are aging F-16s and even worse, aging F-4s. And I think they took a batch of F-16s around the 2000 era. Most of the other ones were built in the 80s and early 90s. And as a consequence, if you look at, say, one of the key enablers, fourth and fifth generation fighters, you know, airborne electronically scanned array radars, AESAs, you know, you've got the Greeks getting them with Rafale, and they've requested, as you say, a batch of F-35s with AESAs. You've got the UAE parking a few of their F-16 Block 60s with AESAs and getting F-35s, we think, with AESAs. And of course, the French with AESAs. There's a recurrent theme because Turkey doesn't have a single AESA, and most of their fighters are, again, very badly aging. So they're playing a very dangerous game. And it could be that nobody calls Erdogan's bluff, or it could be that it does. And, you know, militarily, it's a bit of a house of cards.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, in all of this, of course, makes for a very robust fighter market. You know, I mean, global tensions like these And, you know, of course, as you say, there's this Eurofighter traction. It's sort of, you know, before we started, you know, wondering how many FACOs were enough for a program, Eurofighter kind of set the, I guess, created Mr. Bad Example, you know, four different FACOs at the tune of like between 6 and 8 planes per year. And now it looks like the German and Spanish ones are going to go to the end of the decade. That's pretty extraordinary, you know, so every other month or so, they'll give birth to a jet. Still, it's kind of intriguing that the program will keep rumbling along probably into the 2030s.
And any negative implications for Dassault and French manufacturers in the region, just like there might be some negative repercussions for American industry if a Biden administration gets tough, right? I mean, there's still talk about Saudi Arabia not having a tone for the Jamal Khashoggi murder. Obviously, Yemen still leaves a bad taste in members of Congress, with among some members of Congress, even though the Abraham Accords seem to have changed that overall dynamic for a lot of members.
It is intriguing, but here we have to separate optics from, you know, realpolitik, I suppose. I mean, who are the Rafale export customers? You've got Egypt, led by, you know, an anti-Islamic Brotherhood strongman. You've got Qatar, which, you know, optics aside, really doesn't care at all about religion. And you've got India. They were, you know, the Modi government has been, you know, you didn't need to persuade them to assume an anti-Islamic posture, to put it gently. So it's hard to see how it will really penalize your average Rafale salesman moving forward. If Turkey were an active campaign, yeah. If they had a chance in the UAE, probably, but they don't. They're obviously going with F-35. And, you know, everybody else, I think they'll say one thing for public consumption and then feel something very different. And I don't think it's going to impact French military sales to the region at all.
Sash, your sense on all of this?
I think that in the very, very, very short term, public opinion in a number of Islamic countries is incredibly anti-French. But there's a very, very big difference in many of these countries between public opinion and government opinion. And a French government that is upholding secular values, which is what France is doing. France is not actually being anti-Islamic, they're being pro-secular. Although, you know, that's a difficult line to walk, or certainly it's a difficult one to understand the further away you are from France. But, I agree with Richard. I don't think that this is doing as much damage to France in anything other than the very short term as people might think. But, you know, coming back to the issue of Eurofighter, yeah, you know, the contract that's been announced in the last 2-3 weeks has been Germany, 38 aircraft initially, and there's another 85 aircraft to be replaced, Tornadoes to be replaced in Germany. If all of those go to Eurofighter, which is not impossible, and I think the Biden administration has got a huge amount of catch-up to do there to get any American aircraft in for the nuclear role, because otherwise the Germans will say, look, you know, you want the nuclear role to be done by Germany. You've actually got to help us with the certification, or we will go, you know, we just won't play that game. In which case, Airbus is going to be building Eurofighters into the 2030s, and that will actually tie in really nicely with the SCAF program, which will, you know, they hope will be building up sometime in the 2030s. You know, I think Airbus now has got guaranteed production certainly in Germany, probably in Spain, for as far as any of us can reasonably forecast. It's a great position to be in.
Can I quickly just interject one thought there, though?
Go ahead. I mean,
the fact that Dassault has been given SCAF or SCAF prime contractorship means that I'm wondering whether the whole Eurofighter line extension isn't kind of a bridge to nowhere. I mean, what exactly is Airbus's role on the new fighter jet?
They're going to have a FACO. They're going to be building the thing. They are. I think it is politically unacceptable for all of the SCAF aircraft to come out of Dassault's facilities. So, you know, they will be co-developing. They will have a fraternal share, which we all know means a, you know, less than 50% and no control share, but they will have less than that. What the Eurofighter extension does is it gives them workload to keep their German and to a lesser extent Spanish production lines going until SCAF builds up. I mean, you know, the paradox is they will probably have a higher workload in the late 2020s than Dassault will have, unless Dassault go and win Switzerland and Finland.
Ron, any thoughts on arms export and this issue before we go to British defense and go to your turkey gun?
No, I'm on board with both what Sash and Richard said.
So just one thing, Richard. So you're still confident the F-35 and the Reaper deals will go through with the UAE at the end of the day?
Well, it's a good question. And of course, that's a new administration question. I tend to think that any opposition that has come from Israel was probably just for posturing and just for show and just for bargaining. So it would have to assume kind of a life of its own. And, you know, a few senators have expressed reservations. I still tend to think of it as one of the more successful initiatives undertaken by the Trump administration. And it would be, you know, I don't think there's enough good reason to kill it, to be honest.
We've got just a few minutes left. Sash, the United Kingdom, weeks after ending its defense review that was expected to make cuts to British defense to pave over the latest gap between funding and ambition, as we heard it, the Johnson administration coming out last week and saying that it wants to spend something like 14 billion more pounds on defense for cyberspace and the Royal Navy. You know, Tony Radican must be in seventh heaven at the end of the day. Walk us through what this means and if it's actually real and how it's affordable, especially given where we are now and the expenses we expect, not just with coronavirus, lower tax revenue, but of course, Brexit, which is still in the future and may take an impact on it. What's your sense of this?
We're going to pay more tax ultimately. You know, get over it. I mean, we're all going to pay more tax, frankly, but we on this side of the pond are going to pay more tax. You know, in the short term, we're going to borrow because borrowing costs almost nothing. I mean, it is astonishing how cheaply a sovereign government can borrow. You know, you can borrow 50-year money at 20 basis points. That's, you know, people in 50, you know, frankly, not even my children need to worry about that. That's why, you know, my grandchildren who do not yet exist need to worry about repaying that stuff. So, yeah, you know, borrowing tax, that's how you afford this. What is fascinating is, number one, what a difference the loss of Dominic Cummings makes. Dominic Cummings was very hard on defence, or rather very hard on the Ministry of Defence, which I rather regret he's gone for that reason. I think the Ministry of Defence has been given a free pass here, and bad behaviour has been encouraged, but hey. Number two, the government, certainly the Prime Minister, has realised that defence is a way of stimulating the economy. You read his statement in the House of Commons, and he talks about uniting, leveling up our country, spending across the regions, creating 10,000 jobs annually across the UK, investing in fantastic shipyards and aerospace industry, you know, spreading prosperity to every corner of the UK. Note, by the way, not buying American equipment. I think we will still see cuts to potentially Wedgetail, Ajax, Warrior upgrade, because exporting...
And F-35.
I mean, F-35, that, frankly, that's a given. 138 aircraft is a piece of fiction. I suspect what the UK will do will just be to match the US on F-35 purchases, in which case there won't be very many. You know, we'll buy 60, 80, end of. And invest the money that would otherwise have been spent at the second half of the 2020s on the Tempest program, which sustains British jobs and actually creates a bit of technology. The big takeaway, though, is not cyber, because cyber costs nothing, really. It's lots of rather longer-haired individuals sitting at desks. I mean, the cost is infinitesimal compared to military capabilities, even space, throwing a couple of rockets up in space and some satellites occasionally. That's a billion or so a year. But the big cost is the Royal Navy. And the Royal Navy has gone from having two frigate programs on the go to having a third frigate program, the newly named Type 32, which is, you know, this is another nice piece of Spinal Tap marketing. It's at least one better than the Type 31. It's the next batch of the Type 31 frigate, but with more of everything. So they've turned it up one. And the Royal Navy is likely to get back to having 20, 25, possibly even 30 escorts again over the next decade. They're going to have to man them. That's going to be a big challenge. But the big focus on and the service that won from this splurge of money is the Royal Navy. Be no doubt about it. The Army lost. The Air Force is pretty much as usual. And the focus is on spending within the UK. So this is stimulus money, just as you've seen in Germany. When the Germans want to stimulate the economy, they go and buy Eurofighter Typhoons, military trucks, and that spreads the money very wide. And the UK's learned that lesson, great lesson to learn. So although I regret the lack of budget discipline in MOD, I think spending in the UK is absolutely fantastic.
It's very interesting because Dutch Admiral Rob Bauer, who's going to be the next chairman of the NATO Military Committee, relieving Sir Stu Peach when he retires after just a legendary and extraordinary career, was talking about the fact that Europe needs to step up. No matter what happens with the Biden administration, it's important for Europe to do more for its own security and defense. So that's kind of consistent with that theme. Ron? You're a PhD aerodynamicist. It's Thanksgiving. That means birds. You have 30 seconds to talk to us about your bird gun musings. Anybody knows in the development of airplanes, there's thawed poultry involved to test canopies and engines and all that stuff. The floor is yours, Dr. Epstein.
Yeah, so it's the time of year where we think about sliced birds. And I think, kind of really brings it to mind is, U.S. Airways Flight 1549, the one that, landed in the Hudson with Captain Sullenberger. However, when you do test engines, and this is kind of the time of year we talk about this, there's several tests that an engine has to go through, one of which it has to survive a strike from one large bird, such as a Canada goose, weighing 2 to 4 kilograms, and the engine has to shut down safely after 15 seconds with no throttle movement. Another test that the engine has to go through, it has to withstand a bird strike from multiple medium-sized flocking birds, such as seagulls, weighing 1.5 kilograms. The engine must continue to deliver thrust for at least 75% of its normal takeoff thrust for 2 minutes. And then the final test is, and this was added after the U.S. Airways situation, an additional test where they have to stand impact from one large flocking bird, such as a snow goose that weighs 2 to 3 kilograms. And on that test, the engine must continue to deliver at least 50% normal takeoff thrust for at least 1 minute, followed by a 20-minute run-on period. So to try to avoid what happened on that flight. So yeah, this is one of the things we think about this time of year, engine testing and birds as we prepare for Thanksgiving.
Guys, thanks very much. Really appreciate it as always. Happy Thanksgiving.
Margo, always great to be here. Happy Thanksgiving to you and everyone.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving to all of the other side of the pond.
Happy Thanksgiving to all of you and even those of you on the other side of the pond that don't have the concept.
Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.